Assistant Commissioner Reed Selleck. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Reed Selleck, Assistant Commissioner of the Chemical and Mental Health Services Administration. I've had an opportunity, I believe, to meet all of you, at least in this forum and some individually. I'd like to bring your attention to two handouts that you have that I will be using to just walk us through the budget presentation. The first is a slide handout, a copy of the PowerPoint slides that I will be using to summarize these pages. And it has a title, Chemical and Mental Health Services Budget, on the front. And then immediately after that, you should have the slide, a separate slide that begins with SOS pension reform. And that'll just go automatically in that order, but they got copied as two separate handouts. Okay.
And then if you can just let us know what page in the book
absolutely.
We should be looking at.
To start with, I just want to make a couple comments and as background that we're all very much aware that since I've come on to the administration, that one of the things that we're trying to do is look at the entire area of the administration. And even though I'm going to be presenting budget changes, I want to just highlight that these seven goals that I've presented to you previously continue to course through our mission within the Chemical and Mental Health Services Administration. And you will be hearing me bring reference to the seven goals of eradicating stigma, improving access to the right care at the right time, establishing quality standards of care, integrating care appropriately across systems, reducing cost and improving efficiencies, promoting wellness, and reducing the consequences of the severe illnesses across all of the things that we will talk about today. Essentially, we are the Chemical and Mental Health Services Administration, which is made up of the Adult Mental Health Policy Division, the Children's Mental Health Policy Division, the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division, as well as state-operated services. State-operated services is made up of multiple care centers, the Child and Adolescent Behavioral Health Services, the Adult Mental Health Services, Community Addiction and Recovery Enterprise Services, Forensic Services, Neurocognitive Care Services, and Dental Care Services. What I would intend to do today is present each of our budget pages to you with this format so that we can be as efficient as possible this morning. I will introduce the title slide for the budget page, which will have the page number and the title of the budget page. And then I'll present three slides, one titled an issue slide, which will summarize the issues that this particular budget change is attempting to address. The second slide will summarize the action proposed with the budget page. And the third slide will review and summarize pertinent potential impacts from the budgetary change proposed. And then I'll try to open for questions prior to moving on to the next budget page. And I just want to introduce you to the order that I hope I can make this as useful for your time as possible. The first budget page that I'll bring your attention to is page number 83. And this is the Children's Mental Health Residential Treatment section. And you're on slide number 7 and in your budget book, page number 83. Ready? So this is the Children's Mental Health Residential Treatment Budgetary Change page. Essentially, the issues that we intend to address with this is the fact that historically there has been divided responsibility for the Children's Residential Treatment, or Rule 5, for kids in our PMAP, divided essentially between counties and the state. This is led, we believe, and we've heard lots of feedback on, to inappropriate use of inpatient and residential services due to lack of alternatives. This page is trying to address some budgetary savings, as well as simplifying the residential treatment, as well as addressing more appropriate alternative treatments to inpatient and residential treatment. So the action proposed is to save $5.3 million by delaying the new MA coverage for treatment foster care. We propose to use $3.2 million of the above savings to address the budget deficit. and then to use the balance to buy out the county share of Rule 5 for PMAP children and adolescents, and then to equalize the child versus the adult partial hospitalization rates. currently, there's quite a discrepancy between the partial hospitalization rates for children compared to the adult rate. Having been a provider, I can assure you that the labor intensity of providing child and adolescent partial hospitalization care is greater, and honestly, that's really thought to have been a barrier to having more alternative programs to inpatient care available, and therefore, across our policy divisions, this seemed to be a very logical proposal to keep within this budget page. And then there are proposals here to improve the crisis response availability in some remaining counties that still have not implemented that. So the impact, moving on to slide number 10, would be that buying out the county, the Rule 5 buyout will essentially save counties $1.8 million. It simplifies the administration, and our thought is that this proposal would assure more timely access to Rule 5 placements. Currently, there is an enormous bottleneck in inpatient units for children and adolescents while waiting placement in a Rule 5 facility if they've if it's been determined that they are requiring that level of care. We hope that this will streamline things, improve efficiencies, and reduce the bottleneck, leading to longer lengths of stays of unnecessary utilization of inpatient hospital beds. The impact is that we also believe that we can improve the availability of partial hospitalization and also crisis response services in this proposal and relieve the pressure, as I said, on inpatient hospital beds.
Madam Chair.
Senator Coring.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Sulik, on that last slide, 1.8 savings to counties, is that divided between all 87 counties or so?
Yes. That is essentially that's a saving spread out across the counties because currently every county has the governance to assume the control over the Rule 5 component or portion of it.
So the page says that you're recommending a delay in previously approved new coverage. How long a delay?
Now I have to revisit if that has been thought to be put into the next biennium.
Two years.
Yeah. So it would be put back into the budget following this current biennium, this next biennium, and then in 12-13 it would. The idea is that it would be brought back into the budget at that time.
And when it comes back into the budget, would it be at the same anticipated cost as we're taking out?
My recollection of those calculations is, Madam Chair, is yes, that it would be essentially at the same cost that is proposed at this time.
I guess the reason I'm having a little trouble understanding this, I'll explain my difficulty and then maybe you can explain what I'm missing here. If you're investing some of this savings in these other services, I'm assuming that you would be expecting then more children would be accessing these other services instead of the residential treatment services. So then when you bring the residential treatment services online, you're expecting there would still be as much utilization of that service?
Madam Chair, what I think I can clarify is that the MA coverage for treatment foster care is a step down from residential treatment. So there's multiple components being addressed in this budget page. Addressing residential treatment, that's the Rule 5. The treatment foster care is a very structured, intensive foster care placement within communities that has led to really great outcomes, demonstrating reduction in partial hospitalization, inpatient, emergency room visits, and out-of-home residential, longer-term residential treatment. So this is a different type of treatment that's being delayed until the next biennium.
Um, Well, then the other issue, in spite of the creativity here, that I have is when this does come online in 2 years, it would require new spending because the savings that you're generating here, the investments being made, would not be available to pay for the increased spending. So we have tails here that are not covered. Is that what I am to understand?
John, is that the appropriate? Yes. So that will have to be addressed in the next biennium at this point.
Well, that's not the approach that the Senate is taking. We're not exactly trying to build in future deficits. So now, we may not be successful in that effort, I don't know, depending on what the March forecast shows us, but we're trying not to deliberately build in deficits into the future, because then we're back here having the same conversation that we're having today.
I'm sure I understand. I think that this is a program that we believe in the utilization. I mean, we really believe in the therapeutic benefit of this program and having it available. The fact that it has been pre-approved and hasn't been implemented, it is one of those targets that we can arrive at some immediate savings on and try to be forecasting through in the next biennium how to be implementing this as efficiently as possible. So we'll be bringing forward, our intention is that we will be bringing forward the proposal in the next biennium to be addressing the treatment foster care, the intensive treatment foster care, at the making use of the best efficiency that we can with the dollars that we would propose to be available for that.
Well, just a thought.
Yes.
Perhaps a better way to address that would be not to show it in the next biennium, but to bring forward whatever proposal you want at that time, to bring it forward with whatever spending it needs and how it would be paid for.
Madam Chair, point taken.
Other questions about this page? All right, let's move on then.
Okay, so moving on to slide number 12 is the reform payment method for chemical dependency providers. This is what I try to do with each of these title slides is just highlight which of our policy divisions or areas that this is really in reference to. Multiple issues are being attempted to be addressed here. Obviously, in attempt to look at opportunities for greater efficiencies, an examination of the current rates for chemical dependency treatment was done, and there is an enormous variability currently in the chemical dependency treatment rates across counties, and what counties have negotiated with multiple different providers. There has not been a really arrived at standardization to how rates are established. This is an attempt to get there. Initially, rates for chemical dependency treatment are currently frozen, but originally based on these county negotiations, so we haven't been able to, up to this point, address the wide variance in these rates. There has been no incentive to take care of the more difficult patients or to improve service outcomes at this point in time. And that particularly is an issue, particularly in the field of chemical dependency treatment services. There are individuals who have multiple comorbidities that are much more have much greater degree of complexities in their acuity of symptoms and the complexities of the care needed. And what will be proposed here is a model over time that can help incentivize providers to arrive at evidence-based care programs for individuals with a wide array of complexities and change rate structure in a way that can provide a different rate for care of the more complex. The other issue being addressed in this budget page is that the county share has thought to have somehow discouraged use of the tribal facilities for American Indians, and I will bring points back to this in a minute. The specific action being proposed in this budget page is to move towards a statewide rate methodology, to link payment to performance and to patients' level of acuity and complexity, to seek broad stakeholder input to arrive at that. And while statewide methodology is being developed, we have a proposal to freeze and cap rates at 185% of the average by service type. Okay, now that, let me just take a moment and explain what we mean by that. Given the wide variance, what we did is we looked at multiple ways of just arriving at some place to begin with arriving at a rate structure. Taking the mean of the entire array of rates, taking that mean and looking at where we can arrive at savings and what value to cap at that would impact the least number of total providers but still give us some efficiencies and some budget savings. We chose the rate of 185% after multiple permutations and looking at different rates to different levels to cap at. That is the initial proposal, and what is written into this proposal is that over this biennium, we would be arriving at a way of assessing the acuity and complexity of patients seeking chemical dependency care, and also assessing outcomes and mandating, or at least incentivizing, providers to be using measures to measure outcomes so that there can be an attachment to payment to performance. The potential impact of this budgetary page is to save $10.9 million for the next biennium, to arrive at more uniform and statewide rates, and to have more culturally appropriate placements specifically for the American Indian population available to them. After the new rate methodology is in place, we propose that there will be better outcomes for patients and we'll be able to improve access to the treatment for patients who have greater complexities and therefore have greater degree of labor intensity and difficulty in providing the care for them. How the savings breaks down is that by capping at 185% of the mean currently, we arrive at $3 million specifically in savings. The rate freeze at this current rate saves $8.2 million. And the buyout of the county share for the tribal services costs us $284,000 total.
So, Dr. Sulik, between having probably over 113,000 people losing chemical dependency coverage because you're losing your health care eligibility and taking $10 million out of the rates, do you think there'll be some providers that won't survive?
Madam Chair, I do. I mean, I think the potential reality that we're facing right now is the realization that we have providers that are vulnerable. We have providers that are not making ends meet with their current rate structure given the current demands that they have. So I can't sit here and predict that every provider will be able to sustain the current economic scenario. I think what we need to do and what our administration is very committed to doing is corralling our providers together in the best way possible and coming up with mechanisms to manage through this as best as we can to assure access to care for the most people that we possibly can, given what we have available to us and our resources.
I guess in light of your answer, I might just ask why this area was picked for such a deep cut then.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, it appears that this is an area that has not had a lot of stringencies applied to it regarding the rate structure. And when we examined the rate structure, there has not been any way of determining that the higher rates being paid led to better outcomes. And this is really an opportunity for us to step back and try to examine how to pay more appropriately for the better care and arrive at some savings at the same time. This was an area that really stood out as being an area of potential change that could lead to improvement in care while still achieving some efficiencies in the budget.
Senator Erickson-Robes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question about the statewide rate methodology plan. So that would be a board of people, it sounds like, taking input from providers and stakeholders to come up with the rate setting structure. And does this plan or board then, is that department people? Or who's the group made up of?
Madam Chair and Senator Rupps, if I could ask you to just clarify where you're referring to the board. I missed that.
Just trying to find out who's going to determine the rate methodology.
Understood. Senator Rupps, Madam Chair, the proposal that we have currently is that we would create a committee of stakeholders made up of providers from across the state, and our current reception to the idea, when our division director has been communicating with providers across the state, there is excitement about arriving at some structure and some payment for performance. I mean, we have numerous very talented providers giving extraordinarily good care who really want to see that they can be incentivized to continue to provide that care effectively. And a different rate structure is really something that they're interested in. So our intention is to arrive at a stakeholder committee to help guide us through that rate structure and use that information to come up with the best model we can.
Okay, and then, Madam Chair, to follow
Senator Erickson Ropes.
These folks then are a stakeholder group, but they're still under the auspices of the department. Is that correct? It's not an independent third party that you'll be consulting with.
Madam Chair, Senator Ropes, our intention is that it would be individuals made up from outside of the department, in addition to members from our Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division.
Okay, thank you. Then one other question, Madam Chair. Just to clarify, You're saying that now the governor supports a statewide rate setting for health care services, and he also supports capitated payments.
Madam Chair and Senator Oops, what I can clarify with this proposal is that the capitation of the current rate is an attempt to establish some current freeze to get us to where we really want to get to. Because it's going to take some time to really appropriately arrive at an appropriate rate structure. What I don't have is the visual that I find really helpful, but if I can draw in the air for you, that if you can imagine
they'd be freezing it for 1 year while they figure out what this rate structure should be.
But the complexity of establishing the rate structure means that there's inpatient rates, there's residential rates, there's outpatient rates. And if you can imagine a table with nine cells, those three different types of care, and then low complexity, moderate complexity, high complexity. So that our goal is to arrive at really nine different rates, but to have that standardized. And then if we can arrive at the appropriate measures of outcomes so that we can attach some increase in the rate over and above that current rate based on pay-for-performance model, that's our intention.
Okay. And Madam Chair, I was just more interested in confirming the concept because some of us have been talking about this for a while at the Capitol, that we do need to look at statewide rate setting and some sort of capitation for some services. So it's interesting to hear the governor supports that notion.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Dr. Sulk. In response to Madam Chair's question about there will be some treatment centers that will not survive, and some will not be able to make ends meet. Can you clarify that more? Is it going to be where the good treatment centers with the good outcomes will survive, and the ones that are, you know, negotiable will not survive, or is it more of just a balance sheet that is going to determine which ones are going to survive and which ones will thrive under this?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, my impression of this assessment that I shared with you is that we can't ignore that some providers are vulnerable, that they're really struggling with providing chemical dependency services because their rate of return on investment is not as great as other areas that they may be receiving, that they may be providing service for. And so with that awareness and that reality, I have to sit here and be mindful of the fact that there are some providers who are going to need to work very, very hard to manage through these rate changes and the current economics of our time. it's going to take some creativity, and it's going to take some corralling of support and opportunities to work together. I can't predict, and we haven't done an analysis that to look at every provider and determine who seems to be most vulnerable and who we would predict not to be able to survive. My hope is that they all could, because we need access to care, but I'm also very much aware of the potential vulnerabilities here.
See, Senator, we're losing critical mass here, mm-hmm. and I don't think it's possible exactly to predict how the fallout from that will occur. And then when you combine it with bringing down the rates paid for the people that are left, I don't think there's any way to predict whether it'll be good providers or not that go under. Senator Laurie.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Assistant Commissioner Sulik. Kind of in that same vein, I'm trying to read the chart on page 87 with the by program type, the mean rate and the 185% cap, and then the number of providers affected. And I guess the way I would read that is that number of providers affected are those that are over the 185% cap currently. And so maybe we could get a list of those providers, and it would kind of give us an indication as to who they are that would be seeing a rate cut. Because, I mean, if that's the mean rate, presumably there are a good number of providers that will do just fine. And that could maybe help us get a bead on who's going to be at risk. I mean, I see the biggest numbers are in outpatient programming, 14 providers, and the room and board portion of the adult program. Do you have a list of those?
Madam Chair, Senator Laurie, yes, we do, and I can certainly examine our ability to give that to you. I don't think that there's any complication in providing a list of providers that we propose could be affected.
we have been keenly aware the legislative auditor has recommended it be addressed, and we've tried to address it in past sessions. The disparity in the county share for chemical dependency services around the state. And I notice in this proposal that you're proposing getting rid of the county share for non-reservation American Indians, but you chose not to address the issue of the disparity within the county share for those that are above 15%.
Madam Chair, I guess I don't, right offhand, I don't have enough information about the remainder of the county share to comment specifically on that. I can certainly ask for some more information and provide some additional.
Oh, you definitely should have a tutorial on that.
Because yeah. I
understand
that.
The county share varies from, it's the disparity keeps growing. So, I mean, I don't even know what it is now, but the last time I looked, it ranged from 15% for some counties to 85% county share for other counties. And it's a very strange thing where, you know, the state pays until you get to a certain point, and then the county pays 100%. And then if you get through the donut hole to the other end, then the state starts paying a share again. But the total result is this huge, bizarre way in which we expect counties to be partners with us in this.
Madam Chair, just for a point of clarification, you're referring to the maintenance of effort?
Yes.
Correct? Understood. Now that I have that clarified for me, we are in the department examining how to streamline the maintenance of efforts, particularly for mental health, and there's some additional proposals being discussed with the county to try to simplify the maintenance of efforts areas. That is currently in discussion as well, but I don't have specific details to provide you. But I think as soon as we have something more concrete, I'd be happy to make sure that you get that information so you know what is being discussed.
Well, all I can say is that as I recall, the proposal to phase out the counties that are above 15% over a six-year period per year was less than this cost of taking over the county share for placement of non-reservation American Indians. So it does seem strange to me that that would be a higher priority than taking care of this wide disparity for everybody. Are there any other questions about this page?
Okay.
Let's move on then.
Moving on to budget page number 89, titled The Delay of New Mental Health Services. This is a budgetary page that does impact our Adult Mental Health Division and Children's Mental Health Division. Essentially, the issue being addressed here is the need to look at potential budget savings in the current biennium. The action proposed with this page is to delay the previously approved MA coverage for adolescent assertive community treatment. These are the ACT teams that have been quite successful in our adult mental health program. And the governor's budget mental health initiative approved previously, there was approval for $2.3 million to expand the ACT teams to provide services for older adolescents. There is a proposal here to just delay the initiation, since that has not begun yet, to the next biennium. The second action is to save $750,000 by returning current adult mental health grant underspending backed into the general fund. Normally, these funds would be reallocated for additional mental health services grants. The impact here that is identified is to avoid across-the-board cuts in adult and child mental health infrastructure grants from 2007 Mental Health Initiative by this proposal. Questions regarding that page?
So the delay of the assertive community treatment is until 2013?
Just 1 year. Madam Chair, it's a delay of just 1 year.
Why do savings show up then through 2012?
Madam Chair, John Zockel, DHS Chemical and Mental Health. When this service was budgeted into the MA forecast, it was assumed that it would take 3 years to fully implement. And, so there's a 30-30-30 kind of a phase-in schedule, which has been our typical experience with a new coverage like this, that it takes time for providers to qualify and for the service to become available across the state. So when you delay even 1 year, you push back that whole phase-in schedule, and so it affects the budgeting for the next 3 years.
Senator Laurie.
Then why would the greatest savings be off in 2012? I mean, if it's ramping up, I would assume the savings to be dwindling as you go through the ramp up.
Madam Chair, Senator Lurie, I'll need to check why that number is different in 2012. It should be about the same as the...
Appears to be a typo on the page. The tracking has a different number. Mr. Godfrey, you want to read the number and we can write it in?
Yes, Madam Chair, committee members. The number in 2012 is $1,197,000. So it looks like they transposed the 1 and the 9 on the budget page.
That looks corrected here.
Right.
Well, I guess I just have to say that I generally think that this is a bad idea. I can't imagine why we would want to delay implementation of ACT services for young adults or teenagers. Was this service picked just because we haven't started it yet?
Madam Chair, yes. This was an area that has not begun implementation yet, and it's projected that it would take some time to really fully implement it. So it was the potential immediate saving issue.
and certainly not a judgment about the quality and the effectiveness of this particular type of service.
Question, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Sulik, in the in the appropriations that were given to in the direction of mental health a few years ago, can you refresh our memory as far as any appropriations to adolescents? Was there a push, a portion of, is there any program to deal with adolescents and their mental health?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, I think in this current budget proposal, I'm going to, later on in some additional pages, I'm going to be demonstrating some requests for appropriations for the child and adolescent program in particular. So there's a little bit of offset in regards to that as well. But as far as the previous budget, John, if you have comments on that?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, the 2007 session did appropriate some significant new funding for children's mental health, including schooling services, respite care, culturally appropriate services.
But those were grant dollars that were pretty limited. That was not particularly necessarily even envisioned to serve every county in the state.
Yeah.
This is an MA benefit, and this benefit will help teenagers stay out of the hospital. That's what this is designed for, to provide crisis service at home to people so that they do not need to be hospitalized. And I'm sure we all have not forgotten the crisis we have with getting hospital beds for young adults, teenagers.
Madam Chair?
Mr. Zakel.
Madam Chair, if I could add, within the department, this was a difficult decision. We view this delay as partly an alternative to doing an across-the-board cut to some of those new grants that were appropriated in the 07 session. So one of the things that you'll not see in this budget is cuts in those new children's mental health grants that were appropriated in 07. Those continue in the upcoming biennium as they were appropriated.
Well, it doesn't seem like we should be making choices between either of those, but are there other questions about this page? All right, let's move on then.
I'll turn your attention to budget page number 91. Now, just to preface, I understand that this particular budgetary proposal is going to warrant some discussion. So what is proposed here is to arrive at small budgetary savings, but also to arrive at some standardization to approach to grants. There are certain chemical dependency grants that are currently designated for specific providers based on legislative direction. All the other chemical dependency grants in the entire Alcohol and Abuse Division are allocated based on a competitive request for a proposal. So a request for a proposal that goes out, a competitive granting process. And these are two grants that have been allocated due to legislative action but have not been required to go through the competitive process. Now, the action proposed here is to save $1 million by eliminating these chemical dependency grants, which have a very narrow focus. And the proposal is, as effective January 10th, 2010, to eliminate the state DHS funds for these two specific grants, the methamphetamine abuse grants and the prenatal alcohol grants. Now, the meth grants are divided equally between two grantees. Neither grantee appears likely to spend the entire current grant by contract end date of 6/30/2009 and can extend the current grant that they have. The two grants are Anoka County and one to Faribault Martin County. Data that I have from these two grant programs is that the Anoka County grant provides housing and services for meth-dependent mothers with children. They've had 51 referrals in 18 months. They they've had 32 patients admitted and then discharged unsuccessfully, and they've had 19 graduated successfully during that 18-month period. In the Faribault Martin County, there's 44% of the grant goes to a house where meth-dependent clients live, and 5 clients have completed CD treatment at the Fountain Center. The impact, we fully recognize that there's a potential of some service reduction with this particular proposal. The additional impact is that federal funding for similar services will continue to be available on a competitive basis through the DHS Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division. So these providers will be fully eligible to apply for funding for their programs through a competitive grant process. Taking reductions here helps preserve the current eligibility levels for the CD Consolidated Fund. I'm prepared that this is going to warrant some questions for a variety of issues. So I'm certainly open to questions or dialogue.
Questions? Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Solis, I'm glad to see that you're apprised of the situation that the methamphetamine abuse grants was a creation of by the legislature and the methamphetamine task force that in response to the bill that was passed in 05, and a very successful bill addressing methamphetamine. I think some of your figures might be a little bit skewed as far as the Martin Faribault County, which I should say is one of the two joint human services counties in the state, and they've done a very good job at this collaboration. And I think there should be some merit given to that relationship, that they've developed this program jointly. They've been in joint human services for a long time now, actually. But 44% of the cost is for the house, and five have successfully gone through treatment. I've had Carol Falkowski come to the house several times, and the meth coordinator, Chuck Nuremberg. It's a program that's set up for children, mothers with children, and it is very hard to just put figures on what is going on in that house. I mean, you should really come and look at the success that you've had in that house, because as we know, methamphetamine, and actually we expanded the use of that grant to all drugs, because as you know, meth is not the only addictive issue there. And they've had a very high success, and that's what I'm hearing from the people that are involved in the program. And the people that are involved in the program is not only the county, but the city and the RAM, the group homes, and they all collaborated on it, and they're spending a lot of money on this. It makes me a little nervous about this competitive basis, and I'd like to see the criteria, because this is one program that is working, and they are having results. So I guess I beg to differ on your 5 of completed treatment, but they have to teach them how to do everything, and in this home they do it. So it's a completely different venue for a treatment program, but it is seeing results. Now, I am not sure about the Anoka County one. I haven't kept track of that, but we could probably go on and on and on, but I know we're in a hurry, Madam Chair. But this is one that's very close to my heart, and it has had success.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen.
Dr. Sulik.
What you just described is a very excellent description of the type of criteria that is used to establish, award criteria for grants in a competitive process. The fact that there's joint counties combined, the fact that there's a collaborative process that has led to this, the fact that they have the array of services that they're providing, I have no prediction here that both of these grants are not, both of these providers are not very competitive in the grant process. This really is trying to arrive at some standardization so that we have the exact same approach to granting processes across the entire administration. These are two that have really stood out because they don't fit into the typical approach that is used in every other grant process. So please note that this is not, the data shared is not a judgment on the quality of the services or their outcome data at all. It is just a description of here's the number being served, here's what is being done at those programs that we're aware of. And I absolutely have no judgment on the fact that these are not potentially very competitive applicants in a competitive grant process.
Dr. Sulik, do you believe that we currently are providing enough funding for dealing with the issue of prenatal alcohol abuse and fetal alcohol syndrome or fetal alcohol effect?
Madam Chair, I think that the the whole array of fetal alcohol abuse and the problems associated with in utero exposure to alcohol is an issue that affects and has been affecting children across Minnesota for quite some time. And looking at the same argument that I just gave to Senator Rosen regarding the competitive grant nature, the particular
that
provider.
That isn't the question I asked you, if you mind my asking.
The question is, I don't think that there's probably adequate funding available currently to fully address the public education and the intervention needs to prevent in utero exposure to alcohol across the board. And if we really want to legislate in a way to really truly impact children in the most effective way, we have to be considering how to do that most effectively. At this point in time, that's one very tiny grant that would be eligible for a competitive grant process. As far as trying to arrive at additional funding to expand services and expand prevention efforts, you certainly would have my support in that proposal because it's a huge need in our state.
Well, and fetal alcohol syndrome and effect has tremendous costs down the road. I mean, we call them million-dollar babies because of the impact they have on the cost of the rest of the system, for whether it's through the court system, whether it's through county social services, whether it's through the school districts, et cetera. So it does seem that reducing funding in this area, whether we have federal funds available or not, is maybe not the wisest thing for us to be doing as we look to the future of our state. Senator Sharon.
The statements that you make on the action here for these CD grants is that you eliminate, for example, the prenatal alcohol and drug use grant of $393,000, which really has been an effective program circling women, pregnant women, and addressing drug use during pregnancy. Very effective. But the issue is that you're talking about it is having a narrow focus. And I'm interested in why that is a problem, because by targeting and focusing, it has become effective in addressing that outcome. So I don't understand why that's a negative from your perspective.
Madam Chair. Senator Sharon, I think it's a very valid point you're raising. We have numerous grants that are narrow in their focus, and this is not a judgment of the quality of that grant by any means. I think the narrow is being it's probably misconstrued in the slide, because what is being pointed out here is that these two grants have been legislatively awarded and have not been required to go through a normal competitive grant process, and therefore there's a narrow awarding of the grants, or a narrow protocol arrived at awarding of the grants. But as far as a judgment on the fact that these particular grants are narrow in their focus is not the issue that is bringing this page forward at this time.
Other questions about this page? Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Sulik, you keep mentioning this competitive grant process. So is there a page later on that the savings that is shown here will, in essence, be incorporated into that competitive grant? So what I'm trying to get at is, if we're not providing the funds for these particular successful programs here, Can I look forward to seeing them on some alternative page?
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch.
Dr. Sulik.
You won't necessarily see them on an alternative page because they would, essentially there is a pool of dollars that the grant funds come out of. So in a competitive process, the most competitive grants are going to get access to that pool of funds. So this savings here essentially reduces the eligibility of some other providers if these two providers are more competitive in that process. So essentially the proposal is that they could apply for these same types of funding through the current funding available through the Consolidated Treasury Fund.
I think Senator Lynch is making the same point that I did. However, in the end, we have $1 million less we're spending on treating parents with chemical dependency addictions. Senator Laurie.
And I guess I'll just follow up real quickly, too, about the fact that we will see these costs elsewhere in the system, as you also mentioned. We'll see them not on the budget pages, maybe, but we'll see them in corrections, juvenile justice, our social service systems, and our schools. And they will be there, and they will be very real when we eliminate these effective this funding for effective programs.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Sulik, this competitive grant process, are you revamping this and redoing it, and are we going to be able to look at the grant proposal to see, are you personally taking charge of this grant proposal and redoing the competitive process?
Senator Rosen, these are federal funds that we're talking about.
Oh, from him. For the competitive grant proposal.
Right.
Okay.
So we're beholden to the federal government to keep that level of funding for those grants. Senator Sharon.
And may I ask, and their priorities as well then in terms of what those federal dollars are spent for. What we do here is have some priorities in our state that we've identified that we want to focus and target. But if we give this up and go to just federal program, it's also their federal priorities. I guess that's a question.
Well, in the past, it has been more general in terms of meeting the needs of underserved populations. But I guess if we're eliminating 113,000 people from coverage, a certain percentage of them would have chemical dependency needs, so I guess we'll have a lot more underserved populations than we have had in the past. I don't know. The state tends to define what they mean by underserved populations. Other questions?
I'll just follow up on that. I think that's what we're trying to get at. When we've defined a direction that we want dollars to be spent in these two grants, we've established the priority of the legislature. If this goes away and they become competitive within this other grant program, what we're asking is, how is the decision made as to where those dollars are going to be directed, and how is that selection process going to occur throughout the state, and what's the basis for the competitive grant? Because when that gets out of whack, from the legislature's perspective, then we start going back into getting targeted dollars out of the legislature.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Dr. Sulik.
Senator Sharon and Senator Rosen both. I think what I can speak to is when I was briefed by our Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division Director, Carol Falkowski, about this. Her review of the grants that they currently fund is that these grants would fit into the types of priorities that our division already is funding. And therefore, I don't think that there would be a shift in necessarily the priorities by moving these grants into a competitive grant process. And as far as the RFP process, in regards to your question, Senator Rosen, I would say, by all means, we can certainly provide more information to you about the funding and the criteria being used.
Thank you.
I think just one last comment, and that is over the years, as we have faced budget deficits, the fetal alcohol syndrome programs have been cut before, and so we're left with not very much. It's true. And, you know, it might even be interpreted that, you know, we just have you know, a couple of programs left that are not going through a competitive process, but it's because there have been cuts in previous years in this area. And I just have to say again, I think it's penny wise and pound foolish to cut this service. Mm-hmm. Any other questions or comments? Let's move on then.
Okay, moving on to budgetary page number 124. You have already had this addressed when Assistant Commissioner Brian Osberg was reviewing budgetary changes from health care.
Actually, he skipped over it. He said you were going
to
do it.
Okay. Because we thought it would be pertinent for me to address this. What I would say is that this has this is an example of our attempt to really try to analyze interactions in some of the budgetary changes being proposed, and I will walk us through the line of thinking that went into this this change. Because of the current budget deficit and our needs to arrive at savings, there has been proposal of rate reductions. The community hospital mental health services have historically been exempt from MA and GAMC rateable reductions that have applied to other inpatient services. Mental health patients, we know, are more likely to be on MA or uninsured. And the MA patients constitute about 26% of mental health patients versus 10% for all other patients. If we look at the action being proposed in this page, we have proposed that inpatient mental health services will have a rateable reduction equal to about 6%, or about half of what's being applied to all other services. When we looked at the potential impact of applying the same rateable reduction to inpatient psychiatric services across the state and the impact of the loss in the federal match, having come from this world as being a provider in the community, what I can tell you is that health systems have historically been suffering who have been providing inpatient psychiatric services. Their return on investment is significantly lower on inpatient psychiatric services compared to any other area. So we recognize the vulnerability here. So there was quite a bit of advocacy being provided to try to make this impact as bearable as possible and to look at what's the array of supports that we could be putting into place. This rateable reduction proposed here for inpatient psychiatric services saves $21.5 million for the biennium. A significant savings. However, $4.7 million of new funding is proposed when we looked at the potential impact back on state-operated services and the estimation of increase in commitments and emergency admissions to the community behavioral health hospitals as a result of the increasing demand and the reduction in eligibility and a reduction in access to care and the resources available. So the impact of this is that there are certainly significant contributions with this rateable reduction, not as great as would be if we had applied the full rateable reduction applied elsewhere, but taking into account the particular vulnerability of the inpatient services, arriving at some budgetary changes but providing some protection for them as well. We recognize that we may see some loss of community capacity to provide inpatient care, particularly for the uninsured, especially when coupled with basic care rateable and health care eligibility reductions as well. We have some vulnerable providers, and we're very much aware of that, and I assure you that I am very much aware of that. We intend to see that the role of state-operated services is to preserve the safety net services for those who are committed or need emergency psychiatric hospitalization in addition to providing care for the most complex, as I have described previously. So
Dr. Sulik, yes. It just seems to me like it's a pretty bad idea to reduce spending in facilities where we get Medicaid match to increase spending in a facility where we don't? I mean, just from a jobs and a dollars and cents perspective.
Madam Chair, we are required to provide care in state-operated services for individuals committed to the commissioner. And we need to have, I mean, we very analytically calculated out the minimum estimate of increase in commitments in this next biennium, taking into account multiple factors. We've just received CMS certification for two additional CBHs, and I am providing a high degree of aggressiveness in trying to get the remainder of our community-based hospitals fully certified so that there would be federal funding provided for those individuals as well who have coverage. So I, you know, at this point, this is by no means the best scenario that we can imagine. However, given the current circumstances, what we've been able to do with this particular budgetary change is arrive at some required savings that we were charged to arrive at, yet still provide some advocacy and some protection for our inpatient services. This allows me to have the conversation with our community providers that this advocacy is important, that their needs are being heard and addressed, even at the Capitol, that we're thinking through at the state level how to provide some degree of protection to them and some recognition of the vulnerabilities that they already have because of their cost issues, and try to get the community providers to hang in there with us as we manage through this period. What I'm most concerned about is losing capacity in the communities. You know, all of us at this table, as I've been having conversations with you, I have no question about the commitment to making sure that we can provide access to care for those individuals who need access to care.
I disagree.
So this is a manner in which we're trying to provide some protection in the rates, but also recognizing that our role in state-operated services is going to need to increase, and we're going to have an increase in utilization.
Well, I would say that you're creating an increase in utilization with this page and other budget pages. Senator Prettner-Solon?
Madam Chair and Dr. Sulik, what I envision, I'm already hearing from hospitals that with the cuts that are being taken already, they fear that their bonds will be under call. With that situation, then they start cutting those cost losers or those services where they don't pay for them, such as mental health. Mental health will be the first one to go in every single hospital. And I don't see that we do have a plan for how we are going to take care of those people in our community. And what we are learning now, and something that I've been aware of for, you know, the past 25 years, is that when we have good mental health prevention, it also helps to cut down on medical care. And so we're going to have even more costs in our hospitals again. In every direction that I'm seeing taken in the cuts that are happening in our healthcare budget are forcing those hospitals to take on greater and greater responsibility for the coverage of people who don't have coverage. And those are the hospitals that are they're not going to be able to make it anymore. They're going to be closing. I don't know how we sustain these in our greater Minnesota communities or our metro hospitals either.
Right. You know, the last time that we made significant cuts to hospitals in 2003, one of the services that was eliminated at Fairview Riverside was chemical dependency treatment for adolescents who were dually diagnosed. So, I mean, I just am reinforcing what Senator Prettner-Solon is saying here. These are vulnerable services. That's why we haven't cut them in the past when we've made other reductions. Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Sulik, something that you said, you know, we just need providers to sort of hang in there with us while we try to work through this. And let me just, it's been mentioned, but this is not new to the providers. In fact, we've been using, in many ways, we've been using their checkbook for many years. And so they're not new to this scene, and I think that it's important that we remember what's happened prior to this budget discussion. But just from a policy perspective in your proposal, you talk about this proposal in combination with other proposals to reduce healthcare eligibility recognizes a modest increase in commitments to state-operated adult mental health services. And I just think from a policy perspective, I hope that this committee and others, I think we need to have a good conversation about what the policy direction and the intent is going to be and the priority is going to be in the state of Minnesota. Because as the chair alluded to, a number of things are pretty short-sighted and penny-wise and pound-foolish.
Senator Perkin.
Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would just like to go back to your comment and concern about losing capacity in communities. And I share the same opinion as Senator Prentner-Solon and Senator Lynch has been talking about. And I want to give you one more example. If the department is concerned about losing capacity in communities, this is going to get them there faster than just about anything. I was talking to my hospital folks yesterday on the phone, and we've been in close contact, as most of the senators around the table have been, with their local providers. And I was told, based on the governor's budget, the ratable reductions that we're looking at, it's game over. My local hospital is running at less than 1% margins. And even if we gave them everything that they had now this year, they're carved out, they don't get any cuts at all, they're going to go under anyway because of all the unemployment around the region and people using the emergency rooms. The number of uninsured and underinsured is going to continue to escalate, and that is going to put enough pressure on the hospital system to stress it into near extinction anyway. This is a guaranteed plan to close hospitals.
Senator Berlin.
Senator Sharon.
The other issue that I'm concerned about, and I'd be interested in how you've been thinking about this with the ratable rate reduction, even though you have protected this in some ways as it relates to others, that the state-operated services, the programs that you're talking about supporting and being in place to fill gaps, does not accept, when they accept patients who are medically compromised or have medical difficulties. They simply will not accept them if there's a psychiatric diagnosis and also medical complexity. So we create, when we eliminate the psychiatric inpatient setting, a place where you can address both psychiatric, acutely ill psychiatric, and medically compromised patients are not going to be served by SO, state-operated services.
Madam Chair, all the members of the committee, let me make a couple summary points in response to your comments and questions. First, when we looked at the fact that our commitments are likely to increase in state-operated services, I also examined the fact that the individuals coming to us would likely be having individuals who may have lost eligibility and therefore have gone off medications, not only for their psychiatric issues, but also as a result of medical issues that they may have had as well. Therefore, patients coming to us would be thought of being probably at a higher level of complexity and needing perhaps a longer period of time to establish stability. Yet, if we just had inpatient services alone, then we'd be discharging them back into the community without any care. The last time I was before your committee, I proposed to you the...
Well, of course, those people aren't... See, that's the issue here. The issue is we've got over 113,000 people that have lost their eligibility. So these people are going to show up, some of them with mental illness, in emergency rooms, and not have a source of payment for the hospital. The ones who are left with coverage, the payment gets cut.
Well, Madam Chair, the point that I want to make sure I emphasize to you is the fact that we are looking at our role in state-operated services of providing a much greater array of services so that we can provide more efficiencies in our care and better access to care. The comorbid medical complexity issue has already – I'm very much aware of that issue. We're already examining where our specific facility within state-operated services can be to better care for individuals with more complicated medical comorbidities in addition to the psychiatric issues. So I want to assure you that the aggressive examination of our services is being done at the same time that I'm proposing to you the current budgetary changes in this proposal. In regards to these issues, what I can assure you, what makes this particular budgetary page seem confusing and not make a whole lot of sense if you just look at it on paper is the fact that it is a result of really requiring us to examine potential interactions of the proposals here. So this is an example of us literally thinking through. We can't just talk about budgetary savings without thinking of the potential implications and the impact of this. And then what's our response to addressing some degree of that? And that is that's what you have before you, is that full recognition.
Dr. Sulik, I'm going to just see if anyone else has any questions about this rateable reduction. I have a few other questions about state-operated services. Okay. First question is, why has it taken so long to get these 16-bed facilities certified? You know, when that budget page was presented to us back in 2003, the idea was that we were practically immediately going to get federal funding for these new facilities as opposed to no federal funding in the regional treatment centers of old. And yet we still have how many of these that aren't certified?
Madam Chair, there's now six not certified. There are currently four that have received full certification. There are two more pending. And we're aggressively examining how to get this done. In regards to what has taken so long, there's been essentially quite a bit of pushback. This is the information that I've received as I've come on to the program and really examined this quite aggressively, that at the federal level, CMS has been somewhat understaffed and has not been making they've not been able to make frequent trips out here to get the rest of these services certified. It is somewhat of a new model for them to be examining from a state system as well. We don't really have other programs in the country for them to apply the same approach to in thinking about state systems. So it seems like there's been some complexity previously, but I hope that we're addressing that.
Well, and clearly these facilities are eligible. If they weren't owned by the state, they would have been certified in a heartbeat.
Well, Madam Chair, I am fully aware that it looks like it's taken far too long to get this done, and I assure you that that is one of my absolute top priorities, is to complete this process in as expedient of a nature as possible. We're losing money every day that we're not certified.
Well, and that's the second question I have, and that is how are you financing this operation when the receipt of federal funds was built into the budget process for operating these facilities?
There was, Madam Chair, a significant less income as what was initially proposed with the previous ramping up that you all represented previously. And as we've examined moving forward, we've taken into account the ramping up and getting those facilities certified. We're still able to bill for commercial plans, and we're still able to bill for the facilities that are certified. We can be prioritizing admissions to those facilities that are currently certified. There's some ways of applying some efficiencies in that to get us to improving the revenue.
So over the course of the last biennium, has this been deficit spending going on? I mean, I don't know how to be more direct with you, right, in terms of the impact not having these facilities certified has had on the budget.
Madam Chair, it's the previous proposal was that there would be revenue generated above what was currently brought in from these current from these facilities because of the state appropriation. The revenue goes to the general fund. Right, right. So the previous proposal was that there would be contributions from state-operated services from these facilities contributing back into the general fund, and there was less contributions in the general fund than was initially proposed. However, as we look at this in the next biennium, I foresee because of the new array of services that we're proposing in improving our billing, I think that we're going to see a significant difference.
So are those lower contributions built into the forecast for the next biennium then?
Yes, Madam Chair. That the current budget that we have has taken into account forecasting out our prediction of when we will be arriving at certification in the remaining facilities.
And when is that?
Madam Chair, I just want to get the specific information before I provide it to you. So over 3 years. Okay. Madam Chair, the calculation is based on the assumption of receiving new certification at the rate of 2 per year, taking an additional full 3 years to receive full certification. By 2013, all 10 facilities would be fully certified according to that plan. Any increase in that rate improves revenue. And even though that's the forecast, that's not my expectation that it will take us that long to get there. So a rather relatively conservative forecast was built in, and I hope to improve above that.
We've also heard that these 16-bed facilities are low on their occupancy. We're wondering why that would be and what impact that has in terms of the forecasted budget.
Madam Chair, the 16-bed facilities across the state have not been at full capacity, primarily because of a provider issue, not having access to the psychiatric staff to provide full coverage. There have been some decrease in referrals to some of the facilities as well. What that means is that there's capacity for us to increase our care. And the fact that we have some built-in capacity has been taken into account as we've looked at the estimate of the increased need and increased utilization of state-operated services. So when we estimated what increase of admissions are we likely to see because of this our current scenario, what was taken into account is not just new admissions, but new admissions over and above our current capacity. You will see that there is quite a plan to be improving our relationship and integration with community providers and improving access to care within the state-operated services system.
Well, I don't see a budget page fixing the issue of psychiatrists not being available, so I'm at a loss to figure out how this is getting fixed.
Madam Chair, there has been an ongoing recruitment effort for psychiatrists to come into the state-operated services system. I'm bringing in some new ideas in regards to that. We don't forecast that will require additional money, just perhaps an additional approach to establishing relationships and recruitment of providers into our system.
So you mean to say that you just don't think the department's done as good a job in the past as they should have in recruiting psychiatrists?
Madam Chair, what I mean to say is that psychiatrists are hard to recruit. Particularly child and adolescent psychiatrists, has the greatest shortage of any area of all of medicine. In the state of Minnesota, we're in the bottom one-third of the country when it comes to the number of child and adolescent psychiatrists per capita. Most of the child psychiatrists trained at our two medical schools end up leaving the state and not remaining in the state. So we have an issue, and it's a much broader issue than just our state-operated services being able to recruit effectively or not. It has to do with the workforce shortage. And this is a widespread issue at the national level. We certainly suffer from that here in Minnesota. I've been pretty successful at recruiting child and adolescent psychiatrists to St. Cloud. When I left St. Cloud, we had 5 full-time child and adolescent psychiatrists and 3 full-time advanced practice nurses, making us, at a clinic of 8 child and adolescent psychiatry providers, probably the largest outpatient clinic child psychiatric service in the Upper Midwest. I have some ideas about how to establish relationship with providers and provide some recruitment strategies that could be effective. I hope to be bringing that forward into the department so that we can be taking advantage of my experiences in that regard.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Dr. Sulik. And, you know, I have no doubt that you have that experience in this area and that will benefit from that experience. But from what I'm hearing from the physician in Bemidji, and we had the same difficulty there recruiting a psychiatrist, is that the ability to offer loan forgiveness is the biggest draw, and that there is a lot of competition nationally. Areas where they have those kinds of programs in place are much more likely to be successful recruiting physicians when there's a lot of competition. So I guess I'm just wondering whether anyone's compared the cost of that kind of loan forgiveness versus the dollars we're losing by not having those providers in place.
Senator, we do have loan forgiveness for child psychiatrists in Minnesota.
Madam Chair, well, and again, more generally speaking, or from what I'm being told at least, is that some of the requirements and the flexibility to be able to use some of those programs that are there are not as user-friendly as they need to be. And I'll be happy to get some more details from you about exactly what the impediments are, but that's what I'm being told.
Well, I'd like to understand that better. The loan forgiveness program for a child and adolescent psychiatry works the same way the loan forgiveness program works for other primary care physicians. So,
Madam Chair and Senator, I can provide some clarification to that because you are bringing up a point that has been somewhat of an issue, particularly for state-operated services in the past. I have been a recipient of the Federal Loan Repayment Program, which only qualifies you for federal loan repayment services if you're providing outpatient services. Historically, in state-operated services, all of our psychiatrists have been providing inpatient care and therefore haven't been eligible for the federal loan repayment program. The commissioner's plan that was approved, I don't know how long ago, has loan repayment eligibility built into the Department of Human Services medical specialist commissioner plan. So we have that available to be offering. I've been examining how to put that into place so that it can be used as a recruitment tool and a retention tool. Because we don't only have a recruitment issue, we have a retention issue, not only for the psychiatrists, but for psychologists and for advanced practice nurses in our system as well. And so we hope to be able to figure out how to take advantage of those services, those eligibilities that are there. Part of it is how to present it in an effective way to potential recruits so that they understand, you know, that benefit that's available to them.
So, Dr. Sulik, when you don't have psychiatrists available in order to be able to have the 16-bed facilities fully occupied, where do you put someone when they are committed to the commissioner?
Madam Chair, they get admitted to one of the other facilities available, which is why some of the facilities haven't had as full of capacity as
They might be referred to a facility that's not in their own community.
Madam Chair, correct.
Of course, that is not the objective of having these facilities located throughout the state. The objective is to have people closer to their homes and families.
Madam Chair, that's correct, which is why the recruitment is really a top priority for me, to really establish, get our workforce up to its full capacity.
So, Dr. Sulik, when do you anticipate that the psychiatry needs of the 16-bed facilities will be able to be met so that people do not need to be referred away from a home facility?
Madam Chair, the reality is that recruitment is a long, painstaking process. I anticipate it taking the next 2 years for us to really effectively establish some new recruits within the state-operated services. And I just think we have to have some, we have to be establishing relationships with our trainees as they're completing their residency training. That's something I'm already working on doing. I have a meeting with a child psychiatry fellow who's completing his training next week. I want them to get access to me as the assistant commissioner, but also as a psychiatrist and a child psychiatrist. That's an enormous advantage right now, is to have me in this role and for new recruits to be able to come in and see that there is this degree of support at the leadership level for who they are and for what their task is at hand. And I hope that that can create a different culture that makes coming into the state-operated services seem like a much more exciting opportunity for them. But I have to be honest about how difficult it is to recruit psychiatrists. We're not alone in that regard at all. At the front page of the St. Cloud Times, just last week, if any of you caught that, now this is the community that has had the largest child and adolescent psychiatry service probably in the upper Midwest. Front page above the fold headline was the need for psychiatrists in the area. We have a dramatic shortage of adult psychiatrists in the St. Cloud community.
Dr. Sulik, there is an empty 16-bed facility in Bloomington that's owned by state-operated services, and I'm wondering why it's empty when we have, according to your own testimony, people in Anoka that do not need that level of care.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Mike Tessner, the Chief Executive for State Operated Services. The site that you're identifying is Bloomington. It is an apartment building that was utilized up until 2 or 3 years ago, at which point working with the metro counties, in particular Hennepin County, made a determination that that type of service was no longer necessary. So the building at this point is simply awaiting its next use. As Dr. Sulik is alluding, our intent on expanding the levels of care being provided by state-operated services, the Bloomington site is currently in that conversation.
It would seem to me that before you closed a program, you would be planning for the reuse of the facility and would create a transition that would be smoother than this.
That's a good point, Senator.
Well, as long as you're up here at the table, Mr. Tessner, we have not heard back from the commissioner about the beds at Mito. You are going to go back and look at that issue and get back to us. And then we were wondering when you thought you might be getting back to us.
Madam Chair, I'll start with some responses, and then I'll let Mr. Tessner chime in with some additional information. There was some information forwarded to Mr. Godfrey from Tom Reuter.
Right, it was the value of the cost of the beds.
And let me, I looked at that information and felt like I wanted some additional information as well. And here's what I have to summarize for you, that 100% of the patients admitted to MEDO are admitted under civil commitment due to not only having developmental disabilities, but also mental illness, but also extreme complexity and subsequent safety concerns. There is a number of individuals who are at a lower level of mental illness complexity and can be better served outside of MEDO. That has been one of the historical thought processes leading up to the decertification of those beds, because to care for individuals with lower level developmental cognitive functioning, with extraordinarily complex mentally ill patients with developmental disabilities that have the behavioral disturbances that led to the safety concerns that led to the commitment proceeding. Caring for them on the same campus within the same program led to enormous degree of complexities. There are 48 beds at MEDO, 12 are ICFMR, 6 already have been decertified. There are 6 left to be decertified. That will happen this month. In order to be ICFMR eligible, you have to have skill deficits and ADLs. In the last 2 years, only 5 people admitted to MEDO met criteria for those ICFMR beds. So even though the beds were there, we don't get paid for them unless we have the appropriate person in that bed. The difficulty was providing care for that individual on that particular campus within that program. The average daily census has ranged at MEDO from about 38 to 42 with a peak of about 46. Most of the individuals at MEDO meet the level of complexity for a much higher degree of mental illness, safety concerns, behavioral disturbances, in addition to the developmental disabilities. The proposal that is at hand is to be transferring patients that ordinarily would that historically would have been eligible for the ICFMR beds at MEDO to a program at Pillager that is more residential-based, community-based, and more appropriate of a program for their level of needs. Those individuals would be eligible for a developmental disability waiver, which arrives at us, that gives us the eligibility for federal funding. So that is the summary that I thought would be certainly much
more
meaningful.
Yes, we understood all of that the last time you were here to talk about MEDO. What we didn't understand is why there's no savings being projected in the MEDO program then.
The cost of opening a new facility at the Pillager program and the cost of running that program, the same cost attributed to caring for these patients in a program that's not suitable to them, we still have to provide care for
but
them.
But you're getting federal funding.
Some. I mean, Mike, if you want to.
Well, it's 50%.
Yeah.
Maybe shortly 54%.
Madam Chair, the Pillager site is a adult foster care corporate, so it is fully funded through the DD waiver. It operates on the enterprise side of state-operated services through MSOCs. The reason we can't take a savings in the MEDO program, as Dr. Suwak had alluded, is the census has been running between about 42 and 38, although it peaked about a year and a half ago at about 46. Pulling out those individuals who are really not well-served in MEDO, when we only admitted 5 in the last 2 years, doesn't bring that number down low enough to actually close a unit out. In other words, we need to have space available for that fluctuation between typically 32 and or 38 and 42, but in the upper 40s as well.
So the net of adding a new facility is that we're increasing our costs.
The costs are being incurred by the DD waiver.
Well, that's increasing the costs, isn't it? I mean, we've got another budget page in here that caps the DD waivers because of costs.
Madam Chair, I think you're right.
Well, Dr. Sulik, you strike me as being a fairly creative person. But I must say that these budget pages that you've presented to us today do not strike me as being very creative. So I look forward to better things from you in the future.
Understood.
Any other questions?
So,
all right.
Moving on.
Move on.
I'll just direct your attention to the second slide set. Which begins with the budget page number 139. This is the SOS pension reform page. Now, it's my understanding that when the Minnesota Sex Offender Program was being presented on this budgetary page, that this issue was also addressed with you, but I will just review it quickly for you, making sure that there's not additional questions. I'm going to ask Mr. Tesner to remain at the table for this, because if there are questions, I think he's going to be able to answer those as well. So the issue here is enrollment in the Corrections Early Retirement Plan and the belief that it's really expanded beyond its original intent. The Correction Early Retirement Plan was enacted in 1973 to provide an early retirement option to corrections officers and security counselors whose primary purpose was security within the correction system. Under SERP, qualified employees are eligible to retire at age 55. Over the years, this plan has expanded beyond corrections officers and obviously beyond its original intent to other DOC staff, as well as a number of DHS employees who work at the Minnesota Security Hospital, the Minnesota Extended Treatment Options Program, and the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. The action proposed here is to limit enrollment in the plan to those positions that are only related to security functions within the Minnesota Security Hospital, to move non-security positions from the SERP to the state's General Employee Retirement Plan, to limit the eligibility for paid medical insurance upon retirement at age 55, and to expand vesting period from 3 years to a total of 10 years. The governor's proposal calls for classifications whose primary responsibility is not security to be removed from SERP and transferred into the state's general employees retirement plan. A point-in-time snapshot estimates that this proposal affects approximately 557 employees.
And we did have a brief presentation on this page from Dennis Benson when he did his presentation. I guess the one question that I didn't have time to ask him is whether these employees who have received this benefit negotiated for it and won this at the bargaining table.
This proposal, Madam Chair, my understanding is this proposal originally came forward to the department from the Department of Corrections, and now in wanting uniformity in how this gets presented across the two departments, and therefore at this point I know that you have probably more information as far as the negotiations.
Madam Chair, I believe the health care benefit was negotiated. The early retirement is in statute.
The health care benefit is negotiated. Right. Clarification, Madam Chair, is that the health care benefit is negotiated, but the rest is actually in statute.
Well, it is somewhat problematic for some of us to have the department coming in making budget requests for changes in things that have been negotiated at the bargaining table. I believe if those changes are to be made, they should be made at the bargaining table. Senator Lynch?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would am wondering, I don't have the answer to this, but if there will be a proposal like this coming forward from the governor's office to the pension commission. It seems that this would be an more appropriate discussion to take place in pensions, frankly, than in this division.
Madam Chair and Senator Dr. Lynch, I believe it is being presented actually this evening at the pension committee.
Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, and maybe this is what you were getting at, but both Senator Lynch and I have been in pensions commission meetings when there have been presentations made by different positions within corrections talking about, you know, whether they were the equivalent and should be granted this right. But the difference between deciding to do that, which I hate to think of retroactively taking something away from someone who's been working with an expectation that this is a promise made, but to me that's even more of a problem from a legal standpoint if it is something that's been bargained for as a part of a contract. You know, you made an agreement with someone and they worked based on an expectation that you would fulfill the bargain that you made with them. So that then becomes to me very problematic.
Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd also like to go back. I mean, you did say in your testimony that it was obvious that we've expanded it beyond its initial intent, and I would actually take you to task on that and say that it is not entirely obvious to everyone. I mean, the original intent was recruitment and retention for the programs where people were working in a more dangerous situation, and that, you know, the expansion that you're talking about, I think we need to be clear. These are for people that spend 75% of their time, you know, non-security, but they spend 75% of their time in direct contact with the patients. And I would put to you that that is not a, you know, obviously an expansion beyond the intent of the program. And we have done the recruitment side by offering people this benefit. And they have come with the recruitment side. And, you know, the retention is yet to be worked out. But changing the deal midstream is really... a very difficult proposal for many of us to swallow. I mean, I have people that are 1 year from retirement, that this changes everything, or less than a year. This changes everything. They're not vested anymore, some of them, under this proposal. This is a very dramatic change in people's lives. I mean, I'd much prefer looking at something going forward than retroactively changing the deals that we made with employees that have been, you know, good, loyal employees to the state of Minnesota for many years.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, at the beginning of session, I had asked Council with Pensions to put together a proposal for me that would eliminate the high five for appointed positions, because it seemed to me that under this type, you know, the economic conditions we have right now, that when you have someone who's, say, worked for 20 years at a certain level of pay and then is suddenly elevated into a much higher level of pay and gets to use those years in combination with that higher level of pay, that that amounts to almost like a private sector golden parachute in retirement. And I think that the money involved if we were to limit something like that, would be significantly more than what we're looking at here. And yet I was told that we really couldn't go backwards and take that away from people who were already in those positions, even though I think, you know, as employees at will, I'm not quite sure why legally we couldn't. It seems to me that we're looking at the wrong end of the employment scale when it comes to the people who are the top earners and their employment on pension benefits, compared to these people who've sat at the bargaining table and retroactively taking away from them their benefits. And that's...
Well, Senator, we will ask for the Pension Commission to keep us informed. Are there any other questions on this page? Let's move on then.
Moving on to the state-operated services, child and adolescent behavioral health services, proposal to bring CABS as a core safety net into state appropriation. This is budget page 142. The issue at hand here is multifold, that... In the spectrum of care for child and adolescent services, CABS has gone through quite a bit of change over the last several years, and currently there's been an underutilization of services within the state-operated services CABS program. There's an increased utilization of crisis support options, there's establishment of the Minnesota Intensive Treatment Homes, and there was the consolidation of the inpatient services in Willmar, bringing the Brainerd program down into Willmar. There's been funding issues, and this is a program that has not been able to remain effectively in the enterprise system. What is being proposed at this point, and this is the first of what I hope you will see as a creative proposal, Madam Chair, is that the idea that CAB serves a role in the state. And the role that it should serve is to be able to provide care for those children and adolescents with the most extreme and complex care needs. And having been a child psychiatrist practicing in this state for the last 9.5 years, I assure you that it's these children and these children's families that really struggle with finding services, finding specialized services of individuals who really have the specific training, expertise and support and programming to provide an array of services to best meet their need, not just inpatient, but inpatient, stepping down to either specialized residential versus the intensive treatment foster care and or partial hospitalization, as well as having that specialized team being available to provide outpatient clinic follow-up and monitoring, and also providing consultation to the community mental health care providers and to the primary care providers. That is the proposal is at hand, is to change state-operated services CABS program into an appropriated services to identify our core safety net function of caring for those individuals, those children, and those adolescents with the most complex care needs. The action proposed is the redesigning of the existing capacity into inpatient services, partial hospitalization, and outpatient services, specialized with an area of focus addressing those individuals with complex trauma needs, complex trauma care needs, those individuals with pervasive developmental disorder and other neurodevelopmental disorder issues, and also individuals with complex emotional dysregulation issues. Those seem to be the three areas of specialty care needs that assessments have identified pretty consistently in our state. We have enormous gaps. It's children with those types of complexities that are having extreme difficulty getting access to inpatient services or intensive outpatient services that best meet their needs. The above proposal invests $19.2 million for the biennium, with anticipated collections of $18.7 million. And just to walk us through that, even though this is a request to appropriate CABS so that we can essentially serve the core safety net function and develop this array of services, of an investment of $19.2 million proposed, there is an estimated revenue being generated of $18.7 million from the array of services being proposed here. Before I move on to the potential impact, I just want to emphasize that through the use of technology, through the use of a team of professionals, an inpatient program proposed that is currently in existence in Willmar can have a partial hospitalization program serving a pretty wide region there. We anticipate seeing expansion of partial hospitalization programs to the metro area and also to the central Minnesota area, probably up in the Brainerd area, if not even the Bemidji area. The role of these partial hospitalization programs is to be a specialized partial hospitalization programs, not to compete with existing programs that are in existence. This is to provide the fuller array of services for those individuals at the far end, more complex end of the spectrum of care. The impact of this proposal is to stabilize the funding for the program, fill in the gaps in the system much more efficiently and effectively, better integrate services across the state system and the community mental health care system, as well as the primary care system, and preserve the core safety net services for the state.
So it seems like the problem with this program is that it doesn't have the utilization that was projected. And so the question I have is, why not just downsize the program?
Madam Chair.
As opposed to coming in and asking for what is essentially a rate increase for this program that other private sector programs would not enjoy?
Madam Chair, the proposal that is at hand is really a complete transformation of the role of CABS. CABS, historically, was identified as being an enterprise model to provide acute inpatient psychiatric care services. That didn't really work, and it didn't work very effectively at all, because in order to provide acute inpatient care services for the most complex kids, we need to have the step-down array of services. CABS has never had partial programming. They've never provided outpatient clinic care and monitoring care of patients that have come into the system. The integration of that treatment team with community providers has had all kinds of barriers to allow that to occur. So this proposal is a complete transformation of the identity of CABS and the role of CABS. And I assure you we'll demonstrate significant efficiencies because of those array of services that are proposed here.
Well, I guess I'm concerned that it puts the general fund at risk in the future. And I guess I am.
Yeah, right here.
I mean, if the transformation is one that is needed and there will be utilization, I don't understand why the rates that are paid through the Medicaid program are not adequate to allow it to be financially successful without general fund appropriations.
Madam Chair, what I would I certainly understand your estimate and your assessment of this, and what I can say is that what we can't predict at this point is the overall the degree of complexity of providing this specialized level of care. Currently, there a system like this does not exist in our state. This is a model to try to address the enormous gaps that currently exist in a much more effective manner. And assuming that state-operated services' role is to become the specialist for these children and these adolescents and provide that care better than they can receive anywhere else, because we can assume that that's our charge and that's our role here. So what is at hand here is that there's protection in this program to allow us to provide that that service, to fill in those gaps effectively, but also with the pledge and the assessment and the commitment that this is a revenue, this program has significant potential in revenue being generated. And if we go over and above the revenue being proposed here, that's a benefit to the general fund. What is estimated here is I have to be honest about the time it takes to ramp up services, the time it takes to build up revenue. So this is as conservative as we possibly could arrive at this estimate. But this program has potential to contribute to the general fund once it's fully established.
We'd like to get the fund balance in the reserve account for this program.
I can get that and provide that to you.
Thank you. Other questions? Okay, let's move on then.
Okay. The next is the state-operated services shift dental services to a safety net appropriation as well. This is budget page 144. The issue at hand here is this calls the question if state-operated services should be providing dental services. This is a question that when I examined our administration, I had to ask. And what I have been provided by our providers within state-operated services is that this is a small core safety net function. State-operated services got into the business of providing dental care historically when state-operated services had the institutions on the regional treatment campuses and caring for those individuals in more longer-term placements at institutions. This service has provided care historically in the most recent years for individuals primarily with rather significant developmental disabilities that really would not be able to get access to dental services probably in any other way. And this is not a proposal to expand the current dental care beyond that mission of the core safety net of those individuals with the developmental disabilities and those individuals within are under care of the state-operated services system, but it's looking at the fact that there's an appropriation request because this is a service that, because of rates, has not been able to remain in the enterprise system and has not been able to generate the revenue necessary to sustain its service. The action proposed, I'm sorry?
Does this recommendation have anything to do with the other budget pages that propose getting rid of dental coverage for adults?
Madam Chair, this is a completely independent proposal. It's completely separate from that. And in fact, I have not included forecasting in this that would estimate an increase of referrals based on the loss of dental services. What we did forecast into here is the potential increase of dental care needs of individuals coming into state-operated services with or without dental coverage. We did forecast that in, but we have not intended to expand the safety net of state-operated services, dental services, beyond those individuals already within the state operated services system. The proposal at hand here is to invest $6.62 million for the biennium with anticipated collections of $3.514 million.
So is this request then because you feel that the MA dental rate is not adequate for these individuals?
Madam Chair, for these individuals, the because of their complexity of care needs, these are enormously challenging individuals to provide care for. Many times, these are individuals scheduled for appointments. They come to the appointment, and the service is not able to be provided in one, two, three, or maybe even four visits because of the behavioral disturbances that they have. So it is an incredibly labor-intensive service to be provided.
Right. So would it make more sense to create another rate cell for dental care for these individuals so that we could generate the MA match on the, whatever the investment would be?
Madam Chair, I think that that's a reasonable thought about this. I'm cautious about the fact that we would find providers outside of the state-operated services system willing to care for individuals with this degree of complexity. But
Of course, it would be if somebody wanted to them. Do it, it would sure. be they would be allowed to do it. But it seems to me somewhat of an inefficient use of state dollars just to create an add-on state appropriation for this service if there's a better way to approach it.
Without the match. Madam Chair, I think that that's an excellent thought, and I'm certainly willing to see how we can look into that.
Are there other questions about this budget page? Okay, let's move on then.
I think that's the remainder of the budget pages that I have to present to you. So it's open for any last questions.
We need to move on then to operations and compliance. You want to tell us what page you're going to begin on?
Yes, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jerry Kerber, and I'm the director of the licensing division. Ann Berry had planned to be here, but she had a prior commitment that she couldn't change, so she regrets that she had me here in her place. There are two budget pages that deal with the licensing division of the Department of Human Services, and the first one is page 21, I'd like to start with. Madam Chair, this is titled Restructuring the Licensing Funding. And just by way of a little background here for context, the licensing division of the Department of Human Services licenses about 25,000 programs throughout Minnesota. And we do this under two models. The first model is that we process applications and we monitor programs directly with state staff, and that's for about 4,000 programs. The other 21,000 programs, we regulate them through a partnership with counties, and those would be adult foster care, child foster care, family child care, and family adult day services. Our budget is about $10 million a year, and about 60% of that is from the general fund. We have a number of different types of fees that we collect. Some of them are fees that we collect for background studies, and that's not really part of this page discussion. But then there are some licensing fees that are at issue here. And the licensing fees are the fees that we collect for directly licensed programs, those programs that our staff monitor directly. And that's the only point that's at issue here. What we're responding to here is there's a provision in Chapter 16 that says 16A that says if a government agency collects a fee for a licensing function, it should be about right. It should neither significantly over nor under recover actual costs unless otherwise specified in statute. And so most other state licensing functions kind of operate with that perspective, where they collect a licensing fee that very closely recovers their actual costs for doing the licensing functions. And that's what this proposal is all about. We're seeking to provide some relief for the general fund of $1.4 million at the second year and thereafter. But then also in the year fiscal year 12, moving this funding relationship from the general fund to the state government special revenue fund, as it is for many other licensing functions.
So, Mr. Kerber, could we get a list of the entities that would be paying licensing fees under this proposal that currently are either not paying a licensing fee or would have their licensing fee increased?
Madam Chair, yes. And my understanding is that you may have received that. There's a three-page document that's titled Supplemental Budget Book Information. The first page is Licensing Fee Increase Proposal. Second one is titled Licensing Fee Changes First Year, and then third one is the second year.
So maybe that's in the book somewhere, but I don't know where. Patrick?
He's giving out the folders.
Today?
Look in your folder. Maybe it's in your folder.
They're, Madam Chair, they're landscape documents, if that helps.
Well, I don't seem to have one, so. Maybe we can get some more copies made. Okay, I guess we have it now.
So again, the title of this document is Supplemental Budget Book Information, Licensing Fee Increase Proposal. That's on the top page.
Mm-hmm.
And this this provides a little detail to the different types of licenses that we're talking about here. At issue is $4.5 million. And what we're seeking to do is to recover all of that $4.5 million through fees rather than our current practice of recovering $2.1 million through fees and then getting another $960,000 through FFP for the difference between our appropriation of 4.5 and the 2.1.
So it would seem that we're losing federal dollars in this transaction. Why would we want to do that?
Madam Chair, there is a loss of the FFP. The FFP is 40% of the difference between the appropriation and what our revenues are, and we're acknowledging that. The focus is really on the other 60%, on the 1.4 savings to the general fund. That's really the target here. I mean, that's
right. But it seems like most of these facilities are facilities that only receive government funding, and in the governor's budget are getting a 3% cut in their rates. So I'm not exactly sure how we imagine that they're going to come up with the money for the licensing fee.
Madam Chair, there are a variety of types of licenses here, and certainly there are some that are going to be that would experience that 3% decrease that you referenced. Some are child care centers, some are adult daycare centers, some are treatment programs for kids, for which more than half the services provided these days are funded through private insurance. But a lot of these services are for people with developmental disabilities that are largely dependent on government funds.
So we don't know how they're going to pay for it.
Madam Chair, some of these providers will be able to increase their rates, but some won't.
So we don't know how some of them are going to pay for it.
Madam Chair, that's true.
Are there other questions about this page? Okay, let's move on then.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pretner Solon.
I'm still not understanding why we would forego federal matching dollars for this.
So that we can get a savings on the general fund portion. So what I got out of it.
And Madam Chair, in essence, then we continue to subsidize health care in other states by not taking our fair share.
Well, you know, it is a problem, but I don't think you're gonna it doesn't necessarily mean these pages make sense. They generate a budget savings, but I think it'd be fair to say that in a number of these instances, it would result in a service reduction to clients, jobs.
Madam Chair, one more comment I might add is that the goal of transferring this funding relationship from the general fund to the state government special revenue fund is at least perceived to be one that would provide a little more stability to this consumer protection function of licensing. So that when there are fluctuations in general fund and budget reductions to the general fund, that the licensing function or this basic consumer protection function would be less impacted by that, ideally, and that we wouldn't be making decisions about are we going to investigate less maltreatment, are we going to do fewer background studies, are we going to do less site visits. That, like other agencies that have this relationship with the state government special revenue fund, where they basically are they collect the fees that fund the activity, that we would be aside from that and we could just continue on with that business in meeting the statutory requirements before us.
Would you lose the federal funding if you were charging licensing fees and it went into a special account in the general fund?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure about that. I think that the fund it goes into isn't so much the issue as whether or not there is a state appropriation that's not matched by the recovery of any state funds. And so it's the difference that draws the FRP.
So we can't match a fee that's being charged.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Okay, any other questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was just going to comment that, you know, this is the same thing we saw on our Economic Development Budget Committee, that services that were traditionally provided through the general fund are now being shifted toward a fee-based type of program. And I'm just really confused, because I guess I think the public is getting a confusing message, because I thought I've heard it said by the governor and by some people speaking on his behalf that we were raising very few fees in his proposal, and yet it seems to me like we haven't hardly gone through a fee that hasn't been seen a significant increase, just really across the board. I understand the rationale you're describing, but at the same time it seems to me people would say, well, that's what they're paying income taxes for, or other taxes for, that, you know, if every service government provides is going to be fee-based, that's kind of a pretty big shift in the emphasis of our taxes. So I guess I just think we should at least be honest. If that's what we're doing, we should be telling people that the message is that we're making a fundamental shift in how we're going to pay for government services under the governor's proposal and moving toward a pretty broad-based fee system.
Okay, members, we have one more page, I think, and we have 5 minutes. So.
Okay, Madam Chair, I'll be quick with this one. This is page 19, and this is another fee. you may recall 2 years ago, the 2007 legislature adopted a department proposal where we worked with counties to begin doing background studies for adoption agencies. It was adoption agencies and child foster care. And the change was made in relation to the federal Adam Walsh Act that was requiring a different type of background study to be done on everybody who's in foster care and everybody who's going to adopt a child. And so in order to get some efficiencies, what was done is that all of those background study functions were moved from counties and private agencies to the state. So what we're proposing here is simply to charge a fee for those background studies that we're doing for private adoption agencies. So this would not affect adoptions that are carried out by counties, but this is just private adoption agencies where we'd be charging a fee to.
Are there questions on this page? Okay. Does that complete your presentation?
Madam Chair, those are the two pages that I'm here to talk about, but I think Ms.
Jane Rankin
is here.
Yes. Let's get her up here then.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Jane Rankin. I'm the Budget Director of the Department of Human Services, and I have two pages to talk about. The first one is page 18, which is a reduction in our general administrative operations. And what I wanted to say about this is a $12 million reduction for the 10-11 biennium. This would be a permanent reduction to the agency's base. And the way that we are presenting this reduction is that we would consider it as, we would like to do it as an agency-wide reduction. And that means that's a little different than last year's administrative base reduction for just the central office. We would like this time to deal with the entire agency, so including state-operated services and MSOP. I would say that at this point, there is no, a plan is not in place yet to implement this reduction, and the way that it is presented in your budget books, it's presented as if it would be a proportional reduction based on the operating costs of those three main areas of the department. And that's really at this point just an artifact of how we had to deal with the budget system. We're not suggesting that we would implement this reduction proportionally through those three main areas, but it is the case that the commissioner would like to be able to consider all options across the whole agency in making this reduction.
Ms. Rankin, we want to know where these reductions are going to be made. We want to know how many of them will be managerial positions, how many will be line positions, and which parts of the agency will be taking these reductions. And I think that is a reasonable request in as much as, for example, the sex offender program has a request in for increased appropriations in the budget period that we're talking about, as well as an increase in a supplemental request this biennium.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I understand your point. I would say that at this point in the budget process, we are not...
So when will you have it? When will you be able to answer our question?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it depends in large part, on what the rest of the budget recommendations are for this agency. So
based on the recommendations you're making to us, what would they be? That's what we're asking for. We understand we may not adopt all of your recommendations. I hope to God we won't. But you're the one recommending this budget page, and you're the one recommending the other budget page. So based on the other budget pages, where would these reductions be made?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the agency is not prepared to...
I understand that. The question was, when will you be prepared?
I will have to find out. I don't think that at this point in session that there's any realistic way to provide you the detailed information that you're asking for.
Well, we could make up a plan for you then.
Understood.
All right. Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering how the $12 million was arrived at. And the reason for my question is when the Department of Health was here, they brought forward a percentage that they felt that they would reduce in their operations. And upon further questioning, it was noted that that was an arbitrary number that we came up with. So I'm wondering how you came up with $12 million out of $772
million. Madam Chair and Senator Lynch, I would say that there was no particular percentage reduction that we were shooting for. I understand as you look at the budget proposals across all of state government that you understand, and I looked myself, that there are many agencies that talk about a 5% reduction or a 10% reduction. I also looked, and there is appears to me to be a combination. There's a group of agencies where they're doing an administrative reduction only. There's a large group of agencies, and including the constitutional officers and the other branches, where it's typically a 5% or a 10% reduction on everything and not just on administration. And then there are some situations where it's kind of mixed, where there's both an administrative percentage reduction and other operating reductions in the agency, and I would say that Department of Human Services falls in that last category, where we have both a significant amount of operating reductions in our budget, as you know, because you've heard all the pages presented to you, and yet we are also trying to be responsive to desires to do our work efficiently and effectively support the mission of the agency and the people in the state that we serve, and yet recognizing the environment that we're in, have a consideration that in general we think we can reduce $12 million in the biennium in our administrative operations and still fulfill our mission.
Other questions about this page? Okay, let's go on then.
Madam Chair and members, the other page that I can talk about is page number 23. And this is the recommendation to merge the Healthcare Access Fund with the General Fund. And what I wanted to explain to committee members to make sure that you understand this particular proposal, because it's apparently a little different than proposals related to the treatment of the Healthcare Access Fund in past years. Excuse me. This recommendation is that on July 1 of 2009, so the first year of the coming fiscal year, that all resources and liabilities of the Healthcare Access Fund would be merged into the general fund. Now, I will say that because you've gone through all the healthcare pages and you well know that there are indications throughout of changes, impacts on the Healthcare Access Fund through the budget pages. And we specifically have presented our agency's budget in those terms to make it easy for you to understand the impacts of our proposals. But fundamentally, the reason for this page is because of a view that there's kind of an artificial separation in the area of our state's public health care programs between the general fund and the Healthcare Access Fund, and that it causes some administrative complexities at our agency and also at MMB in the accounting system, for example, and that it would be cleaner to merge the two funds, merge the Healthcare Access Fund into the general fund.
Well, Ms. Rankin, I can just bet you my bottom dollar that if there was a deficit in the healthcare access fund, this page wouldn't be in this budget book. Complexities or not. Are there any other questions about this page? Okay, I think we're done. With that, the meeting's adjourned.
Thank you.